Welcome to the Leadership Show. If there was a time for conscious leadership, that time is now more than ever. The Industrial Revolution undeniably shaped the modern world. It gave rise to incredible advancements and progress, but also left us with unintended consequences. Sustainability wasn't part of the conversation, whether by oversight or by design. And now we face the challenge of maintaining the modern world we've created. Today, we stand at the dawn of a new era, the sustainable revolution. This revolution calls on conscious leaders, leaders who understand that our future lies in creating shared value for the planet, people, and of course, profit. This is what we refer to as conscious capitalism. In these episodes, we will be unpacking the essence of leadership for a sustainable future. We'll have critical discussions on how we as leaders can move beyond short-term thinking and focus on the core principles that will secure a future that is resilient, inclusive, and sustainable. Join us as we explore how conscious leadership can drive change, foster innovation, and ensure that the decisions we make today can lead us to a future we all want to live in. Barry, without further ado, a warm welcome. I'm so excited that you're here today.
Thanks, Carmen. Thanks for the lovely intro.
Oh, no. It's so amazing just to see how your career has spun. And, you know, I'm curious to know, what has sparked this passion for the work that you do? How did it all begin?
A great question, and I've reflected on that a lot over the last, without giving the game away, over the last four decades. So a lot of the work I do now with leadership development and personal development is around finding that one thing, purpose, calling, passion, whatever you want to term it. And in that process, I reflected back to when I was a kid, trying to find out why I ended up playing drums as my way of making my way in the world. And what I found out from lots of reflective writing and really digging deep, sometimes comfortable, sometimes uncomfortable journey. I think the phrase that I came to was when I was 10 or 11, I started playing drums professionally in bands, which meant if I go back a bit, I probably started learning the craft and mastering the skills when I was 5.
Sure.
And so then the question is, why did I do that? And I don't actually know. I was just like a heat-seeking device looking for music as long as I can remember from my first formative memories. That's all I wanted to do. Why did that happen? I have no idea. However, what I figured out was my passion to play drums for people? Yes, maybe. But the real passion was to move people in a positive way. And the drums were just a conduit to that. So I saw guys playing drums in shops on stage, and I thought, that's very cool. I like that. So I developed mastery in the drum set, but the actual core reason was to activate, to get people to build community through a positive response. That's what really got me off, and that has followed through my whole trajectory. And whenever that does happen, whenever that stops happening, then I look for something else. And so with what I'm doing now with executive education, my purpose is still the same. I'm just not using the drum set.
Wow.
Still performance in a way. And in some ways, an MBA class is a tougher audience than 20,000 people that have paid to come and see you play hits.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's a smaller but tougher audience, but it's performance nonetheless.
Mm.
So my common thread has been to move people, activate for positive change. That's actually been the temperature, the frequency that I've been looking for all the time, that I'm still looking for.
You know, that's quite profound for me, is really understanding the why of your purpose.
Yeah.
And so that you always know that that's the compass, the GPS coordinates. And when you're not feeling it anymore, that you always have that home to return to.
Yeah.
You know, that heart space to return to. I love that. And, you know, just to touch on, you know, the inner work that you've been doing and also going back to your childhood and trying to understand that, it's so important to go back.
Yeah.
And to go back to that younger version of yourself, because most of the answers lie there, because it's because I think the previous interview that we had with David Joshua,
yeah.
He was talking about, you know, under the age of 6 years old, you're an emotional being. You're reliant on your feelings as a child.
Yeah.
And those feelings is the compass that guides you as to where you need to go. So it's a very important time of your life is to go, you know, before those 6 years old. Who were you? What were the questions you asked? What was the curiosity all about? What was the world that you envisioned? And that is usually the breadcrumbs to the bigger picture.
Yeah, I would agree. And I'd also say that you touched on an important theme there, and that it's feelings.
Mm.
So it's emotions, which are our interaction with the world. We make sense of the world pre-language with emotions, and then we attach labels to the emotions, rightly or wrongly. So it's all perception-based. But for me, to get people to feel things is more important than labeling things.
Oh, I love that you're saying that.
So that's kind of my area of interest, is to borrow from Eckhart Tolle, to rise above thought.
Mm.
Because if you can do that, you can get into a crazily rich, creative and innovative space. So oftentimes, because we're multi-sensory beings, language can trip us up because we constrain to a certain number of words, you know. So how do we, and we understand stuff so deeply that we can't possibly put those into words. Words become cumbersome. So how do you rise above the limitations and really get to what you felt as a six-year-old? Because at that point, as that open sponge, you probably had a good take on what your thing was, you know. What is the purpose that's going to drive me here? And I would argue that probably ebbs and flows during your life, but it's probably in existence from a very early age. And I would think even maybe pre-language. So,
I love that. Yeah. It's so profound. You know, I was listening to a podcast the other day by my friend Shannon McLachlan, and she was talking to Dr. Kyla Pretorius about neurodiversity, ADHD, etc. I can't remember the actual terminology, but people with, especially with autism and I believe with ADHD as well, have this thing where they go into their heads, right? And they think and they have feelings, but they have no way in understanding how to articulate it. And there's that frustration, and that's why always going into the head is a safer space.
Yeah.
But it's almost seeing when a person asks the question, there's about 20 answers to it, or there's 20 polls, and it's choosing usually what a person wants to hear, because you don't want to go there where you are seeing multiple answers to the specific question.
Yeah.
And it comes back a lot to emotions and not understanding how to articulate our emotions and our feelings. But what you're saying is it's actually a good thing to actually go deeper beyond words, because those feelings are actually so important for you to understand the waves to understand if it's a conflicting emotion or a good emotion.
Yeah. And that's and that's a choice.
Yeah, it truly is.
You can choose that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me. And then the other, you know, without staying in this highly abstract space for too long, but the other thing is the voice that's I've got a voice telling me what to do. I've got my own voice in my head saying, okay, you need to get to the podcast studio by this amount of time, so therefore you're running a bit late. What happens if there's going to be traffic on the way there? Can I find coffee?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what it's going to be like when I get there. I've got this narrative going all the time. So is that narrative me, or is that a voice based on previous experience that's just driving me nuts? I'd say it's more that.
Yeah. You know?
So how do you turn that off and not get directed by the voice in your head? So it's a very interesting question to ask yourself. And there's ways to get into that, to actually to rise above that. But in order to do that, you need time and you need energy and you need space, you know.
Yeah.
So mostly we don't have that. We don't allow ourselves to have that. So it's a my friend Pepe Marais, who you should definitely have on the podcast if you haven't already, says there's a reason. You know, he's talking about stillness and quietening down the noise in order to create. And the lovely phrase he uses is that there's a reason we're called human beings and not human doings.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that. That just kind of sums it up. Sounds easy, but it's really complex. It's really difficult to achieve. But that for me is more exciting. That for me gives me the same excitement that I used to get from having to from learning my drum set or learning music, you know. So this is a new energy source, because it's so powerful, and there's so much stuff that can come out of this.
Yeah.
If you start getting it right.
Yeah. You know? And to that point, I mean, as we now dive deeper into creativity, I think in a world that is often so busy, I mean, in a world that we actually have technology that's supposed to make life easier, we're more busier than we've ever been before.
Yeah.
And taking that time to actually be quiet and to be still, to tap into your own creative algorithm.
Yeah.
And not looking out for superficial algorithms to teach you other people's thought patterns, but actually understanding the wisdom that sits within you and how you can create. I mean, what is your view as to how stillness has been so deprived of society, and how to get back to that for creativity?
Yeah, I mean, rightly pointed out, because currently we are the most noisy we've ever been as a species. You know, on the one hand, it's really cool because we're a social species, and we tend to create and innovate together. We do that really well, but at the same time, with the advent of social media and all the AI noise now, it's becoming a superpower, a necessary superpower to have the tools to turn that off.
Mm.
And there's various ways you can do that, and you know, there's tons of resources on Google and on YouTube for how do you ring fence your time, which is your most precious resource, which you can never get back.
Mm.
And in order to create and innovate, you need time. That's your one primary ingredient. So how do we do that? And then when we have the time, how do we make sure we maximize the output, the return on our invested time? How do we make sure we maximize that? And then the other part of the equation is, are we arriving in that designated time with fully engaged energy? Because if you're not, then you're diminishing the power of the time.
Mm.
So, there's this equation of time plus fully engaged energy equals exponential creativity. And so that for me is something to really pay attention to. And right now, more than ever, we have to figure out ways, biohacks, to make sure that when we sit and focus and we're creating as professionals and we're innovating, that we are completely free of distractions, because we're more distracted now than ever before.
I love that you're touching on that. There is, do you remember you spoke about innovation conditioning in one of the short programs at Henley that I attended? And it really got me thinking about this whole process of biohacking. And one of the things I just wanted to, and I would love for you to take us through this whole concept of innovation conditioning and the biohacks that we need to create. But something that really fascinated me was how I had this conversation with Dr. Adriana Marie. She's a metaphysicist, and she was supposed to go to Mars, the one-way ticket to Mars, and never come back. And we met for coffee in Cape Town together with one of our advisory board members, and we're sitting having coffee inside a building. And she says, ladies, I don't know if we can finish up this cup of coffee. I just want to tell you a story. If I had to be in Mars right now, I'd never ever would have been able to go outside. I would have to be in an artificial building.
Right.
We are so privileged to have nature. Can we please go and drink a cup of coffee outside somewhere?
Huh.
And she made us settle the bill, and we had to go outside to go and have a cup of coffee. And that really was a big aha moment for me, how we are surrounded by artificial,
yeah,
and not actually using nature as a form of a way to access innovation and our purest form of creativity, being surrounded by it. Why do we have to be in boardrooms to brainstorm? Why can't we do it in the botanical gardens? Why do we always have to be in boxes? Get outside the box, yeah, to innovate outside of the box.
Indeed.
So, yeah. What is your view on the innovation conditioning and how that ties up, and how you, for example, had to conduct a piece of music or, you know, plan for an audition, how would you create spaces for that?
Mm. So she was going to sign up for a one-way ticket to Mars. Is that what?
To set up the colony in Mars. It was okay. A big thing. She was one of the top 100 that was selected.
Huh.
And it was a whole process, but it went bankrupt. But okay. That has not stopped her. She's busy with the Africa to Moon project now.
Oh, cool.
She's very much into off-world projects.
Okay, great. I'm gonna check her out. For sure.
I'll introduce you.
So my perception, because we each have a different view of the world, my belief is that I'm connected to everything in the universe,
mm,
let's say on our planet. So from myself to my groups, to family, to friends, to communities, to societies, to living things, to the natural world.
Mm.
So that's a big audacious system, but that systemic view is my belief. I think I think we're all connected to each other and in service of each other.
Mm.
So using that as my thesis, I think getting into nature is an incredible way of opening up creative flow. So I'm kind of stating the obvious, but I think the reason for it is it's a great way to connect to something more powerful than the individual, to realize the power of the individual at the same time,
mm,
and also to just stop the noise.
Yeah.
So I'm all up for the coffee outside. I think it's a brilliant idea. You know, having meetings outside while you're walking,
mm,
running, swimming,
mm,
being in the ocean. I think those are all conduits to a state of flow and to creating the conditions for success, so that your output is more successful than not.
Mm.
I think that's, for me, that's the driver.
Because
can you win all the time? No, obviously. But if you're taking the right action and making the right decisions, 60% of the time, that's a pretty good metric in my opinion. And then that compounds over time. So I think being outside and being in nature is an absolute necessity and door opener in order to build creative output in the age of AI,
mm,
and to leverage humanity, you know, champion humanity.
Yeah. And access the human potential.
Yeah.
So I want to bring it back a little bit. I feel that creativity has been over-intellectualized. And creativity is something that we all have, but we have to develop our creative muscles, our creative algorithm.
Yeah.
When we look at creative leadership and what it means to lead your team creatively, in your view, especially with the World Economic Forum stating that, you know, critical thinking and creativity is one of the top skills for the future, what does that actually mean from a business perspective? Why is creativity so important? If I can actually just go onto ChatGPT and I can ask it to come up with ideas and then I can just build on it, why do I need to tap into my own creativity?
Well, I think what you said there is spot on, and that's actually the clue. That's the perfect segue, because firstly, we're firmly now in the economy of ideas.
Mm.
That's, ideas are more valuable. They're the most precious commodity. Arguably, they always have been, but right now, innovation and creativity are just the states we want to get to, you know, in order to produce the next trillion-dollar industry. So, how do we how do we find best practice in terms of creativity and innovation against this backdrop of, I'm talking specifically about entrepreneurial and organizational activity that's based on thought rather than action, you know? And the best way to do that is to speak to people that have made or speak to industries that have based their output on creativity and innovation. So stand-up comedians, theater actors, musicians, great speakers, you know, performance artists, great improvisers, jazz musicians. I would argue that that's where the best practice in terms of creating ideas would lie. And so a lot of schools are doing that now. The Hindi play in this space, and one of the leaders globally is Stanford, in Stanford GSB in Silicon Valley. They actually have a module on the MBA specifically looking at this. It's called strategic communication, and all the best practice are from the industries I just mentioned. So the world, I think the focus has moved from keep the crazy idea people on one side to bringing them into the mainstream now and main focus, which for me as a creative is well overdue, you know. So for me, this idea of what as humans can we do in what's our unique humanity and what's our unique offering in this exponentially advancing world of large language models, robotics, and so forth. It's creativity and innovation, and you mentioned empathy. AI is a while away from being able to do what we can do. And the one thing for me that is really clear, if I visualize it, what you said is you can get ChatGPT to write you something, then you can refine it. So what I said earlier about time and energy, what we need to create and to innovate is time, and we need fully engaged energy. We were spending a lot of time, a lot of the heavy lifting. If you can imagine a sculptor making a new piece, you're first chipping away the block to get the broad shape, and then you refine it. We now have large language models that can make the shape for us, save us an enormous amount of time, cognitive oxygen, and then we can come in just to do the creative stuff. So it's actually giving us, it's conserving our energy and creating time. So for me, the answer is humans that can use AI very well. That's the future of creativity and innovation, because you can, surely it makes sense to me that with more time and with more energy, you can be more creative, and you can use AI and robotics to do the work that needs less cognitive oxygen, less creative energy.
I love that. How can leaders foster creative thinking within their teams and organizations? And what is the ROI of investing in creativity and creative leadership, and also enabling your team to open up those neural pathways for that creative flow?
Yeah. So you took notes at my Hindi class there, because I was talking about, I'm fascinated by corporate finance and valuation and all the ratios and whatever. That's my passion. And so, you know, there's this metric called return on invested, I'm almost saying it the wrong way around now, return on invested capital, which is basically how much you get back for each dollar or rand that you've invested. And so I've swung that to return on invested creativity, which I think is a really interesting metric. And I'm trying to work on ways to measure that. Obviously, you can't measure it with the same precision as finance, but I believe that you can apply integers to creativity and come up with some sort of approximation of what you're getting back from your investment. And so I think I think it's an extraordinarily powerful reality or sense of purpose. If you can say, well, when I sit down to be creative, and I do believe you need to sit down to be creative, I think waiting for inspiration means you're an amateur. And if you're a professional creator, i.e. that's what you do, that's your purpose, then you have to show up and do it. you can't wait for inspiration. So, but the interesting thing is when you show up and do it, most of the time inspiration follows.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So I think that's a very, that would be one of my first thoughts to land with a team when you're asking about leaders and teams. I think it's about viewing this as a professional endeavor without sucking any of the fun or creativity out of it at all.
Yeah.
But actually showing up at the designated time and doing the work, and then making sure that the time that you're using is ring fenced from distractions, and then also making sure that as a being you are arriving with fully engaged energy.
Mm.
And so for that to happen, you have to take care of the obvious things: nutrition, hydration, rest, you know, and then you can get deeper into all of that. Exercise, you know, things like breath work, mindfulness, an energy giving, an energy fueling diet, making sure that you have enough sleep. Without that, you can't be fully engaged. It's impossible. So, as an aside there, an interesting thing is in sport, in elite sport, which I'm fascinated by because it's quite similar to my journey as a musician. A lot of the focus now in elite sports on recovery, not performance, because sure. the focus is on if I can recover faster than the competitor, I can win the match or the game, or I can sustain multiple wins over a time span. And so recovery has been the focus. So there's a lot of attention now biohacking intervals between performance. For a tennis player, they play a point and then they've got 30 seconds before they play the next point. How do they recover in that 30 seconds? And that's become a very specific science. And in business, this doesn't happen. In the organizational world, it happens a bit, but not enough. And so executives will pride themselves on lack of sleep, working long hours, partying hard and still showing up. All the stuff that's destructive for their performance, for their energy.
Yeah.
So are they showing up with fully engaged energy? No, because they're not paying attention to recovery. So I think this is something that has to get brought into this creativity and innovation conversation, because without fully engaged energy, you can't possibly create. It's impossible. Mm. So I'm going down a rabbit hole now. But you got your time, and you've got your fully engaged energy, and then I would say, you know, that's the first point to land, and there's ways of getting into this, as you probably heard me talk about at that Hendy session, with particular types of theories and models and biohacks, which are simple to use. And then the other part, chapter two, would be the myth that only certain people can create and innovate.
Mm.
I think that's something to take away,
yeah,
straight away, you know?
I just want to add to that. There's this perception that innovation's only within technology. Like, there's this whole huge perception that creativity and innovation can only exist within technology. And you even hear it in conversations. And it's something that we all have access to. That was what this whole world was built on.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's also the myth, you know, when you say creativity, most people polled would say film, fashion, music.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere in there, or
yeah,
art, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, creativity and innovation is a much bigger subject. We all have it. We have it as kids. Nobody's not creative.
Mm.
Nobody doesn't play.
Mm.
And then I think the creativity and the openness to explore gets educated out of us. That's my theory. And if you're a fan of Ken Robinson, he talks about that very eloquently. So for me, firstly, we can all create. Can we all compose music, dance and design software? No, but we can all create and innovate in a unique way as unique beings.
Mm.
So I think that's the first myth to dispel. And then the second thing is in my opinion, innovation isn't coming up with something that's never been done before. I think innovation is more about assembling what's already there in very creative ways.
Yes.
That's most of what innovation is. All the big game-changing innovation, electric vehicles, the iPod, the iPhone, all of these groundbreaking new industries are actually reassembling elements that are there already.
Yeah.
So the ability to think creatively and to see beyond what's there and to be able to join dots and see new patterns, I think that's in there is creativity, you know?
100%. It's like convergent and divergent thinking.
Yeah.
The Greek mythology, they believed in the Greek mythology that what created the universe was chaos.
Right.
Right? And if you look at what creativity is, it's holding chaos. It's absolutely a divergent and convergent world and holding that tension between those two worlds. You know, what's interesting for me is always when you see somebody that has become successful in what they do, they always start by saying, I didn't know what I was doing in the beginning, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it leans into your point, what you were saying earlier, is like ideas start shaping and forming the more that you start working on them.
Absolutely.
So you have to be working on creativity to recognize that it exists. Our bodies create every millisecond. As we're sitting here, our neural networks are creating new pathways. There's so many things happening within our body, the cells that are expanding. So that energy of creation is always at work.
Yeah.
So we just need to come back to putting it out in the physical world all the time.
Yeah, 100% right. That's my opinion as well, you know?
Yeah.
And it's also a heap of fun at the same time.
I know.
I think the fun gets sucked out over the, maybe over high school and undergrad learning. I don't know when it leaves, but at some point, you know, at some point when you're a kid, you stop playing. One day you're playing and the next day you're not.
Yeah,
and I think it's the same journey. One day we open to complete divergent thinking naturally. What was the beautiful thing that Ken Robinson did? He gave kids something. He gave kids maybe an iPhone and said, give me as many ideas of what you can do with that object. And the little ones, like 5 or 6 year olds, I'm messing up the numbers now. You can actually look at the TED Talk, but if I paraphrase, the little ones came up with, say, 200 ideas. And then he took it to 14-year-olds, and they came up with 50 ideas. And then early 20s, they had 12 or 13 ideas, most of which were constrained by the thought of it being a technological device. But the little ones were talking about door stoppers, weapons, dusters, you know. There was no judgment.
But that's such a true point. It's like... Yeah. This is also something that I believe in a society that's so superficial, like we are too scared to express ourselves, and there needs to be a psychological safety in a place where you can actually express yourself. And what's also interesting to your point is, wasn't there a research study that was done by NASA where they found that children under the age of 5 years old were far more creative, and by the time when you reach over your 40s, you are 98% less creative than you were when you were 5 years old.
Yeah.
And it's a whole new way of relearning how to be creative. And the only way is to play like a child and to go back into that childhood innocence and almost taking on that archetype in your life and doing things. I did something very crazy. Can I tell you what I did?
Yeah,
you would appreciate this. I can tell you this. So I studied numerology as something that I wanted to do that's esoteric, that's very different from academia, because, you know, I want different things to rent up space in my mind. So I went and I learned about that. My teacher said to me, Carmen, I want you to go back to your childhood and I want you to remember the foods that you ate, the activities that you did, and to do those activities again. I thought she was crazy, so I remembered. I used to play snakes and ladders, and by the way, it's actually snakes and ladders is to learn the lessons of karma. It's a very interesting, the whole concept behind it, but anyway, I was playing snakes and ladders, and then I started remembering conversations that I had with my gran and my mom and the activities that happened around that activity. And when you start enjoying the foods and the things that you ate as a child, it brings back the memory of the things that you've forgotten.
Yeah.
And that was such a powerful exercise for me and really allowed me to tap into a space where I could really go back and just, you know, be fearless and not be so judgmental on myself.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Must try it. It's very cool.
The stuff that you know that you've forgotten, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's also what innovation for me is resembling a lot, is that we forget the old, because every time when we innovate, we're leaving something old behind.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know the whole world is saying to us, you know, we don't need to worry about the past. We just need to worry about the future, because you can't do anything about the past. But the past teaches us a lot of valuable lessons. But there's things that have been done in the past that we've left behind, that if maybe if we take that thing and we take something that exists in our current world and in the future world and blend that, that is where great ideas can come from.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you said earlier, I completely resonate with, and that is you start from a place of chaos.
Mm.
And leaning into a place of chaos means you need to lean into the fear.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm using the right word, but you got to lean into discomfort, let's say, and put yourself in a vulnerable position.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it is. And then just get busy and make it up as you go. I've spent my whole life like that. Even doing the MBA at Henley, when I started, it was complete chaos because I didn't know what it was. And so the idea of forming something meaningful out of chaos is really, really powerful. And
yeah.
I think fundamentally that's innovation.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the trust or the belief in yourself or in somebody else to lean into that, then innovation and creativity is really hard.
Yeah.
Because then you just stay with the neural pathways that you're used to. But to forge new neural pathways means discomfort and leaving stuff behind.
Yeah.
So, it is the most exciting occupation and journey on earth.
I think so. I want to tap into this other very abstract way of thinking about ideas. I was reading a book. I will put it up on the screen. I think it's all about creativity, and this author talks about how ideas have consciousness. So when you surround yourself with people that have great ideas, and when ideas have consciousness, when you cognitively decide that you are not going to do an idea, that idea's energy shifts around you.
Yeah.
And the people that you surround yourself with, those ideas can transfer from one person to the other. And that was a very interesting concept for me, because if we look at the world, we go, oh, you know, how many times have we come up with ideas and I wish I did that,
yeah,
or I wish I implemented that. But have you actually got up and done something about that idea that came to your mind, or did you just leave it hanging?
Yeah.
And somebody else who you maybe get in contact with, or were at an airport, or were you moving past, might, you know, be the one that picks up on that thought, because we don't really understand our intuitions at this point in time and our sensories and how much we are taking in that we can't see with the naked eye. But it does inform how our brains work. We don't know. But ultimately, if ideas come to your mind and you really believe in it, be curious about it and go and explore. You never know. It could change your life.
Yeah, for sure. And ideas are energy, you know, and frequencies.
Exactly.
And so when you're in a group and you're sparking ideas, the pathways are firing and tuning into similar frequencies.
Yeah.
You know?
And so there's research studies that actually prove that. To another point, so I've been very curious about choirs, and where that is going and how that ties up into leadership. And one of the studies that I came across was talking about how there's research that's been done. When people start singing together, their hearts start beating together, and they actually, that is how they start harmonizing at a heart level, not just a voice level, and how that actually brings joy and hope into the mind. And also there's other research studies that also claim that when people are working together and from a collective intelligence perspective, when people are stress-free and they feel safe, when they create, they're actually in alignment with ideas and can build on top of each other's ideas, whereas when there's tension in the room and there's not psychological safety, is that people never get along, or the ideas, there's always conflict around the ideas, which was very interesting to me.
Yeah, totally. I'm fascinated by that, and I love the choir thing. It's actually, I haven't thought about human voices resonating, but that's a really powerful instrument that I'm gonna check out, because I think transferring that to organizational culture is wonderful.
Mm.
And it's kind of a demonstration, I proposed, showing that we're all connected. We're connected beings in ever-expanding circles. So that kind of resonance effect is a manifestation of that, where we suddenly go, oh, wait a minute, I'm tuning into the frequencies of everybody in this group on an almost molecular level, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. You're resonating. And that's going back to what we said right in the beginning, that's far beyond words and intellectualization. That's a feeling. You know, that's the way we make sense of things at a very profound level. And I think as a leader and as a team member, to have that understanding from a offering and service point of view, as opposed to just taking from the world, but perhaps thinking about flipping that and saying, well, what can we come up with that's an offering that's in service, as opposed to how do we exploit an opportunity?
Mm.
It's kind of looking at the same phenomenon from two different ways, but I think that's a very powerful position. And I've been paying attention to what very successful founders talk about, and there's a lot of recurring themes around service and offering, as opposed to exploiting and taking.
Mm.
And it's almost like if that's your stance, the energy, the oxygen, which is measured in finance, will follow, as opposed to focusing on the finance up front. It's the wrong way around.
Yeah.
So I think this idea of looking at choirs and profound ways that humans resonate, watching a TED Talk, watching Ken Robinson doing a TED Talk, I'm pretty sure that if there was the opportunity to do a neuroscience experiment in real time, you'd find that the brain frequencies were probably pretty aligned to what was going on in his head. He managed to transfer what was going on in his brain into a large audience, which is why he was the most viewed TED Talk, I think, of all time. So it's another version of the choir story, you know?
Mm.
So for me, that's... the answer's in there somewhere. I feel like the X-Files, but it's in there somewhere, you know? And I mentioned before the podcast, I've been doing some work because for the folks on listening to the podcast, a lot of the work I'm doing is transferring my experience in the business of rhythm to the rhythm of business.
Hmm.
So I'm using rhythm as my central theme, you know? So, and then rhythm you can talk about as resonance, as harmony, as frequency. They're all versions of rhythm. And rhythm has an action and it has a recovery. You can't have a rhythm without that. You have to have silence between a musical pulse and a next musical pulse. Otherwise, it's just a note. So in order to have rhythm, you have to have the recovery aspect. So what I was talking about earlier about elite sports people focusing on the recovery is also a musical term. It's also a musical notion, because in music you have to come up with surprises. You've got beats and rests. That's all you have.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you put the emphasis on the rest, the silence, not the beat. It's the same. It's the same philosophy as what's going on in sport. You know, focusing on recovery. But anyway. I've been fascinated by this the effect of understanding frequency and rhythm transferred into organizational culture, because I work for a business school. That's my scope of reference. Otherwise, it's too wide. And in organizational life, where I've been trying to get to is for people to feel things, as opposed to just existing in their head, realize that they're physical beings. And once you can get to that space and get into a space of stillness, that's when real creativity and innovation is allowed, is unlocked. And so after a lot of conversations, a lot of trial and error, talking to a lot of smart people, John Flismas, one of my favorite bouncing boards, I got to this this realization. It's my realization, it's probably been realized by others, but for me it was a cognitive moment, in that our primary rhythms as humans, if I'm looking at rhythms as ways to unlock the stuff that we know that we've forgotten we know, One of the best ways to do that is using musical rhythm. What are our primary rhythms as humans? Obviously, I missed this for years, but obviously it's our heart. Mm-hmm. That's our primary rhythm. Without the action and recovery of the heart, which just carries on going forever, when that stops, we don't exist anymore as physical beings. And then the next aligned primary rhythm would be our breath. Mm. And the two influence each other. One, we can control our breath. The other, we can influence, we can't control our heart. But just getting that understanding, that brain-heart connection, to be something that's felt rather than talked about is extremely profound.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Wow.
And so what I've been doing is getting groups of teams into a room, and I've figured out a way for them to articulate their heartbeat in a group.
Sure.
And we do that for 5 minutes. We get into a mindful state, and then everybody feels their heartbeat and vocalizes it. And through trial and error, I've got a sort of a methodology that works now. And the extraordinary thing is that after, so some people, the average human heartbeat's around 60 BPM, beats per minute, the resting heartbeat. But depending on how much espresso you've drunk, what medication you're on, how fit you are, you know, a whole lot of variables, the heartbeats vary, you know, from somebody that's maybe a marathon runner, the heartbeat might be 55 or 50 beats per minute. Somebody might be on some sort of medication that their resting heartbeat's 100 beats per minute. So there's variability, you know.
Mm.
But if you do this exercise, the fast heartbeats, you can hear them slowing down to meet the slower ones, and the slower ones speed up to meet the faster ones. You can hear it in the articulation.
Oh, wow.
So people aren't doing this consciously. It's actually the heart's...
oh, my word.
Being kind to each other. It makes my skin prickle.
Oh, my word. That is incredible. Yeah.
And I've seen it now a few times. I'm not just saying it should work. It actually does work.
Sure.
And if you had time, if you could do it for maybe 30 minutes. I've never tested it all the way to singularity. But I think at the end, if you sat in the room long enough, you'd end up with one single pulse.
Do you think that this is a way to bring harmony amongst the human race?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if people realize that we're all connected.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting into one lens would be Taoism, that everybody's connected in one. Mm. This is a demonstration of that. So when you realize that you're connected to every other human on the planet, irrespective of geography, role, race, social standing, that's a very profound thing. And then you can only be in service after that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, I think we live in a time where it's so easy to be dissonant. It's so easy to just, you know, have blinds on and not actually seeing the world for what it is and not interrogating our own self-awareness and who we are as human beings and just doing a checkup and to make sure that how you perceive the world is it really valid or is it just your own biases and your own conditioning or world models stepping in. And, you know, doing exercises like that, bringing you into the rhythm and into harmony with each other, allows for empathy to really be omnipresent.
Yeah. Well, that exercise is the most primary version of empathy that I've ever experienced.
Wow.
Because it's completely beyond language.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Sure. That is something. Now my ADHD brain is going to want to go, curiosity, I want to know more, You should write a white paper on that.
Yeah.
That is really incredible.
I believe the neuroscience term is entrainment.
Entrainment.
So the hearts will be entrained.
Wow.
So they'll start getting closer. So,
sure.
Yeah. It's fascinating. But, you know, Carmen, just to build on what you were saying earlier, in terms of biohacks and how do you practically tell a team, I want you to have better and richer ideas?
Mm.
Well, you can get people into a room and they can do the entrainment exercise and have a lot of profound moments, but it doesn't really help. So, you know, it's building the scaffolding, but in my opinion, you need practical hacks, you need biohacks to open doors and to get people to see things in a different way. Because this is all about stopping or starting or changing habits. It's what we're doing, and it's really tough to do. But so for me, because I spent my whole life practicing an instrument, so I'm used to showing up and doing the work and practicing. That's part of my DNA. And actually, the last time I played music for my living was in 2018. So what are we now? 6 years later, I still feel guilty for not practicing.
Sure.
You know, I still have to tell myself, "Well, wait a minute, that's not your world anymore." But that's how entrenched the habit was. So if you're going to get people to change positively and lean into their creativity, where do you start?
Mm.
Well, firstly, I think we can all create, and secondly, let's take the hypothesis that innovation is taking what's there already and reassembling it. So based on that theme, something that you can do, just as an example, you can just you can have an idea muscle workout, a calisthenic workout, like you'd go to the gym because you want to make your arms bigger, or you want to run to make your lungs stronger. How do you do that? Well, you just start in small bursts, right? And it works.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't that work for creativity? I believe it can. So something that I often share with teams is just develop your own workout. Show up at the same time for the same duration every day.
Mm.
So you take the cognitive load of deciding when and how long to create for. So you just say, at 8 a.m. every day because I'm a morning person, or at 8 p.m. every day because I'm an evening person, I'm going to show up and I'm going to do a calisthenic creative energy workout for 10 minutes. So now you know what time you have to show up and for how long. So now what you have to, after a week, you just show up. So it takes that load away. And then take a piece of paper and, you know, use the most powerful brain-body connection, which is writing pen on paper, and write down five ideas to a brief. Give yourself a brief. No judgment, no viability, no reality. Just it could be an opportunity and it could be a challenge. In the days of our ESCOM challenge, it could be how to fix ESCOM. Come up with five ideas. How to launch a new coffee shop franchise in Johannesburg that's never existed before. Five ideas. Anything, you know. Mm-hmm. So the idea is not to, it's not a viability study, it's a creativity exercise. So the idea is to think as wide and as divergently as possible. And showing up every day and writing those five ideas to some crazy brief just expands your idea muscles exponentially.
Mm.
And after 30 days, if you haven't felt a shift, then stop.
Yeah.
If you have felt a shift, then carry on. But that's an example of a really powerful, really simple habit-changing biohack that anybody can use and just build confidence and creativity.
I love that. Yeah. I have a deal with myself. So in the mornings when I wake up, I've got a book, and the first idea what's in my head that I have, I write down and I look if I can implement it in the day. So doesn't matter how crazy it is, and I use conscious leaders as the conduit for that. So it could be a post, or it could be looking for a research study, or, you know, putting an event together, or whatever the case might be. I will take that idea and see how I can actually tap into it and actually make it a reality. Whether it flops or it works, it doesn't matter. It's an idea that came to me, and I want to learn how to execute downloads.
Yeah.
You know?
It's fantastic.
And it's really been, and it was a commitment I made to myself, because my word of the year was creativity.
Okay.
So it was a deal I had with myself this entire year, and it's taken me onto a complete new journey of my life. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
So that's why I truly resonate with what you're saying, is like, you know, taking ideas and working on them, your creative muscle or your creative algorithm really does get into a rhythm. It really is incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love that. So you're putting that frequency into the world.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful thing to do.
Yeah.
Cool. Good to
listen,
you.
I've had such a phenomenal chat with you. I wish we had more time, but I just want to say thank you so much for opening up my mind about creativity. There's so much more to explore. I mean, if you really want to dive in, I mean, take notes and really dive into some of those TED Talks that were mentioned. We'll drop them at the link below, but also just, you know, get your mind going and practice all of these incredible things. Thank you so much for today.
Thanks, Carmen.
Do you have any parting thoughts?
No, just my passing thought would be just follow the fear. Follow the chaos and follow the fear. I think that's the route to innovation and creativity.
Yeah.
And finding out who you are.
Yeah. 100%.
Which is maybe all the same thing.
Yes. And it will, either way, you're going to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you explore and you become curious about who you are and why you're here. One of the longest journeys in our lives is the journey from the head to the heart. And may you take this insights and just lean into it and lean into your own inner creative conduit and just spread that out and spread the frequency out. And may you embrace creative leadership so that you can become an army of critical thinkers that can help shape tomorrow in the sustainability revolution.